Welcome to Metacast. I am Josh Anderson.
And I am Bob Galen.
Our topic today is team.
You're jumping the gun.
I am?
You're jumping into... Welcome to beautiful downtown Cary, North Carolina. You have no introduction to this morning, Josh.
It's my introduction was we're talking about the team.
This is
more than the team?
Let's do a little setup here.
All right.
So we've had two other sessions where we've talked about what? I'm almost forgetting. So first... It's been a while since we've gotten together on a Metacast, so we want to apologize to our many fans that we know we've left a void in your lives, but we're back.
Yes.
We're back in the saddle again, and we're committed. We've renewed our commitment, and we're back. So thank you for bearing with us, and you are now going to see a renewed energy in the Metacast.
Yes.
How about that?
Sounds good.
That's a good way to start.
It is.
And then,
maybe you should open Metacast from now on.
I could. But I like the sound of
you like
voice.
Just listening to me do it and then telling me how I've done it wrong.
Yeah, I do actually. Yeah, my secret is out. Damn, I hate when that happens. So that's the Metacast has been away for a little while. So we're back in the saddle and we'll get going, and we have a lot to talk about. So we never lack for words.
No.
when we get together.
We do not.
That was an implied me, I guess. This is the third part in the series where we're talking about responsibilities, as my dogs are going crazy, of teams. And we talked about the Scrum Master, and we talked about the Product Owner, I think.
We did talk about the Product Owner.
Okay, so now we've circled around to the team. Generally, we're going to talk about roles and responsibilities, expectations, patterns, and anti-patterns.
Correct.
Barking at the appropriate time.
They're a member of the Metacast team.
They are a member of the Metacast
team. They are a key support group.
So hopefully they run out of energy. So what do we want to start with the team? Could we define the team?
Ooh.
Sometimes it's nice to start with definitions.
It is. So the team. It's everybody.
That was punning it to you, Josh.
Yeah, I know. The team, I've had something on a slide that I presented once that Bob took a little offense to, where I had the team as a picture, of course I had them as a picture, as a circle, with the product owner kind of living on the outer orbit of that product owner, trying to show that the product owner is in the team, out of the team, going to talk to the users, going to talk to the clients, whatever they need to. So the question I'm posing to you is, in the classic team definition, would you include the product owner and the scrum master?
Well, you know I do. So you sort of punted and yes, I like to consider them. Now, I always, the subscript is always, they have different roles. For example, the Scrum Master. Sometimes I talk about Scrum Masters having a leadership role where they would jump up on a soapbox and actually be prescriptive to the team. They might, yell at the team, or they might say, guys, our quality really, stinks here. We need to do something about our unit tests. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if every team member has that soapbox responsibility. So I think the Scrum Master I like to think of them as a team member, but they're different, and the product owner the same way. I like the team behavior. That's the debate you and I have of, I want the mindset. I want the Scrum Master and the product owner to think team first, not think career first, not think I'm going to throw my team under the bus.
Right.
Right. In order to protect myself, but really honestly think of, I'm a member of this team and I have some skin in the game.
But for our discussion today, as a separate role of the team, do you include them as a part of this discussion, or are they...
I think we can include them as maybe just some of the behaviors, some of the dynamics, if we get there in the discussion.
Right.
For example, retrospectives. Something that I think helps a team get better is the retrospective. So we could differentiate between the team's role in the retrospective and maybe the product owner and the scrum master in the retrospective.
Okay, because what I'm trying to do is really separate the team as they are the ones that deliver. Right.
I'm okay with that if we want to go with that. Do you want to go with that definition for today?
Well, I think, at least for part of this discussion, because we covered the product owner and the scrum master and their role within the big team.
Well, then let's talk about delivery then.
So I'm talking pure pigs.
Well, pure coding, testing, typing pigs.
Right.
that are producing lines of code and users implementing user stories on a backlog.
Right.
So folks implementing stuff on a backlog.
Right.
I'm good.
Okay.
With that.
Okay. Okay. So, all right. So the question that I've heard posed in another conference I was at was, who's responsible when a sprint fails? Is it the Scrum Master? Is it the team? Is it the product owner? Or some conglomeration of all three? Now, to me, I think the easy thing is all three, right? That as a whole, you are responsible. But it's the team role, the ones that are delivering, that
so
fail to deliver.
You're like killing me here because, one, you like made the distinction of the typers of the stories. But then you just made my case of why do I like this notion of Scrum Masters and product owners being part of the team. Failure is one of the perfect cases.
Right.
Please, product owner, don't spin away and say, oh, my team failed me.
Right.
No, you failed yourself. Right, you were part of it. You were part of the dance of that sprint. So, but let's not go there. Right. So so the team, however we couch it, to me the team is responsible for failure. The team failed. Which was your question?
The big team or the
team.
Small team?
Let's not get into how big or how small. It's the typers, the folks implementing failed.
Okay.
Because that's how we couch this, right? I would count the Scrum Master failed and the product owner failed. The big T team failed. But let's talk about the little T team in this case. So they failed as well.
Correct.
Right. I would, so... So your point was?
What? You obviously don't want to get into this discussion right now.
No, I'm good with this discussion. Well, yeah,
I'm couching it by agreeing with you. I know what you're doing.
Okay. So you're agreeing with me. So failure is a big T team moment. Let's say, how to fail would be something.
Don't.
So how do you expect? Don't. Could you expand on that a little bit more, Josh?
Don't fail.
Don't fail.
No,
really? Do you mean that?
No. I had a team meeting with my big team, a couple weeks ago, where I encouraged them to fail. And they're like, but wait, you tell us that we're not allowed to fail a sprint. You know, that we're supposed to do everything we can and not fail. And I said, well, that's different. What I'm saying is that we can't be afraid to fail, and we need to be able to try new things and get sick and tired of the monotony of how we're doing and maintaining, right? We need to find ways to excel, and you excel through failing on trying new things and things like that, but not, you know, having failed sprint after failed sprint. That's not what I was encouraging.
It's weird that teams look at it, it's like a big F. Now we're in this theme of big F, big letter and small letter, right? It's big F failure and little F failure. They always look at it, I think, as a big F failure. And to me, I want teams to have little F failures. Like, what would be an example? I'm trying to think of one. Someone tries to. We use PHP Unit at work, and there's different unit test frameworks for PHP. A few of them, and there's different tools. And so, a team wants to try to make unit tests faster, the development faster, and in a sprint they try. They try a new framework, and they fail. Let's say they just fail. We were trying the other day to hook it up to Cucumber, which is a middle tier test tool, and we actually succeeded in that. But what if they would have failed? What if they would have taken some time and tried to wire up? We were actually trying to wire up a translator between PHP Unit and Cucumber, and because PHP is not very popular as a language, so there's not a lot of open source support for it. So we have to invent some of our own stuff. And what if they would have failed? What if they wouldn't have done it in the context? I would have looked at that as a win, personally, right? The team was, they were trying to do something small. They were trying to stretch themselves.
Yeah, I look at anything that a team tries like that as a win. I don't care if they fall flat on their face, the fact that they're trying to get better. That's all, as a leader, you can ask for. Is that they're not happy with the status quo. They're like, we've got to find a way to get better.
That's sort of what I'm saying. So that's stretching I want. Now, you know, in its largest essence, you could have, total catastrophic sprint failure.
Right.
Even that doesn't scare me. I mean, it does. I know it doesn't scare you either. Right. You just don't want a repeated set of those things.
Right, exactly.
And I want the team, I don't know if I use this with you much, but that notion of failing forward. There's this guy, Maxwell, I forget his first first name, but his last name's Maxwell. He's a leadership author on. He's got a sort of a religious background, but he wrote an entire book called Failing Forward. And I like that notion of, you know, when they bring up things like Einstein and who was the light bulb guy? The guy invented the light bulb, Charlie Watt.
How are the two of us not able to answer that question? Isn't that,
that's embarrassing on the
Alexander Medicaid. Graham Bell comes to mind, but I'm like, no, we're not talking telephone.
No, we'll get there. It's early in the... So, Metacasters, it is early, and the fluid in the brain cells is slow to move. The point is, what was the experiments? Like 1,000 experiments,
right.
1,000 failures, and then one success, but what was noteworthy is a success. And you know, you use those things to make the point of stretching yourself,
right.
of learning. So you fail forward with the learning. I think that's the essence of Agile to a great degree.
Yeah. I actually, in that same discussion, I showed a clip from my favorite Disney movie, Meet the Robinsons, where it's a inventor and his whole thing is keep moving forward. It's that same kind of thing where as a kid he just, you know, things keep blowing up but he keeps moving forward. And to me that's a great message that I try and send to my kids and to my team, and like, let's just keep trying stuff, you know, because at least we're trying, right? That's all I can ever ask.
It's weird though that, I mean, in my teams that I'm coaching, they're very failure averse. It's almost like this fear. Do you know why? Because I've noticed it culturally. I mean, is it a schooling thing? Is it a parental thing? Is it a, you know, stigma? You know, we don't like Fs in school.
It's a cultural thing.
Cultural? Yeah, it must be, because I don't see a lot of stretch.
Right.
Right? Of course there's stretch, and people try, but not the way...
Stretch in effort, but not in stretch in creative new approaches.
In creative new approaches, and just not worrying about, is it going to work out or not, right? Innovation. And just doing it for its own, so exploring.
Well, and it's tough because in our business climate, everything is about delivering something that can be sold, right? So if you're stretching, you're not working on stuff that can be sold.
So you're not working on your story.
Right.
See, that's probably part, you know, maybe we're not fostering it enough. Do you foster, you know, that notion, that Google time where they foster innovation? Have you tried that at all?
Yeah, so the way I've done that in the past and the way I'm starting to do it at my current job is at the start of the year or at the end of the year, we, as a team, discuss things that we'd like to learn. And because I really find it hard to identify effective and money well spent on training for senior developers, right? When somebody's new, there's a lot of stuff you can send them to a test-driven development class or things like that, not just an advanced C# or advanced Java class. Like, those really don't get you anywhere.
Yep.
But there are those research projects that people want to just try stuff. So we try and empower them with 10% of their time. So what I have them do is spend a week researching one of these projects, and then their deliverable to the team and to their peers is a lunch and learn session where they present what they did and how this can or cannot apply to what we do. And if they fail, that's fine. It's not, people aren't judged on whether it works or not.
Yep.
It's, as a team, we all vote, basically throw up a bunch of stuff up on the board. This is stuff we like to learn about. And then we all vote and we rank them from top to bottom. And then you grab the one you want to work on. And we all agree this is something we should try and figure out. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. That's fine. But at least we know that's something we can check off our list. So that's how we approach that. Everybody is very vocally and verbally supportive of it at my current job, but getting it in place is going to take a little bit of arm twisting.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how it was wherever I've been. You know, so we have these training dollars, right? So people are willing to spend dollars on training.
Yep.
So we have like $30,000 we can spend on training. But I'd say I'd rather not spend that and spend it on internal research where, yeah, we're going to spend about $30,000, probably a little bit more than that. But the $30,000 we spend, we also have to realize the cost of losing someone for a week. So in the end, it equals out. It just feels a little bit different. But people have trouble because they can't mark it off on their budget and things like that, so it's hard for people to grasp the importance of it.
I don't remember if you and I ever used innovate. So we have something now that we call Innovation Days. I've done it before to other companies. We call it Developer Days or something like that, where in between releases, not in between sprints, but in between release sequences, we'll take 2 or 3 days and just let team members pair off in groups, whatever groups they want. So we'll put up a wiki page. Mm-hmm. It'll be an idea brainstorming. What we're looking for is folks to propose an idea that then people gravitate towards.
Right.
It has to be business related, so it can't be inventing a game or something like that. So it has to be sort of product, but very loosely product. So it could be fix a nest of bugs that bug me. It could be implement a prototype, typical new feature. It could be do some research into Cucumber.
Right.
So grab an open source tool and try to do an interface to it. It could be things like that. And we've done it a few times because of our release sequences are long. Our release sequences are like 10 weeks or quarterly. We've only done a couple of these things.
I wish ours were quarterly. But that's another discussion.
That's another discussion. But we're starting to get some really interesting traction. At the end of it, we actually have a sprint demo or an Innovation Days demo where we invite the company in to take a look at the stuff.
Right.
And it's we've gotten some traction. I think this release we have, I think, three meta stories. They're sort of sizey. They're not just, it's a couple of user stories that were generated by Innovation Days that we're implementing. We actually threw them then on backlogs.
Cool.
So a product owner grabbed them and said, you know, I want that as a high priority.
Right.
That's sort of innovation, getting the team to do some of that. The first one was really rough, actually. The first one, I don't know if folks didn't think we were serious.
Right. And it's a new way of thinking, right? So people are kind of finding their way. So after that first stumble, they're going to pick themselves up, do a little retrospective, I hope, and say, okay, that didn't work so well. You know, we need to do a little bit better and fix it from there. So that's, you got to expect that, and you got to be willing to accept that. So
we're trying to generate that creativity, that ownership. I think a lot of it sometimes is proving to the team that you mean what you say. You know, maybe that takes time to do that, right?
Right.
It's one thing to say things like, let's be agile or let's be creative. I want you to fail. They're probably looking, I think, mean it.
Right.
And it's not a game that they're trying to fail, but, you know, so you can't predict the tempo of failures and things. What about retrospectives? So I started a little bit, I mentioned, so how key do you think retrospectives are to the team?
It's the secret sauce.
Oh my gosh, that was a bold statement. Are you going to back that up with examples and stories of real life adventures?
No, that's exactly what we're talking about. You take a look at what went well, what didn't, and you find ways to fix it. Where I get really frustrated is where teams come and say to me, we don't want to do retrospectives anymore. And I say, well, why not? And they say, well, because we're not getting anything out of them. Well, why aren't you getting anything out of them? Because we don't take actions on the things we identify in our retrospectives. Well, why not? And you get this dumbfounded look. And it's like, I don't know. Like, then take action on it. Make it count. Make it worthwhile. You know. So that's how you try things. That's how you identify things to try. So that's, to me, a team that is running well and becoming very productive is very productive in their retrospectives and in the outcomes from it. And what I've pushed with teams is make it a story within your sprint. Make it part of your definition of success for that sprint. Because people get so focused on delivering what they've committed to, especially in our culture, that once you commit to something, you deliver on it. So the non-tangible deliverables, like a retrospective improvement, is the first thing to fall off the list. So that's one of those things that we have to push to always. We have it up on boards. We have it printed everywhere, just so people can't get away from it.
Yep. The observations I have is I haven't gotten a lot of teams that come to me and say we don't want to reflect anymore. I haven't seen that, or I have seen that with like long. Sometimes I think in the book, Schwaber talks about like 4-hour retrospectives.
Nope.
So I've heard of teams, it's in all seriousness, that they go in and they time box a retrospective to like 4 hours. And they make the team, the team, that's the ceremony, so they make the time fit.
Right.
And I just can't imagine what that's like. That must be the most painful thing on the planet. But so I think in those cases I could see teams bailing, but I've never had a team that directly talked about bailing. But what I have seen is I'm trying to characterize it. They sort of take the soft bits. So they take the easy bits in the retrospective. And they don't really attack what I think of as the more challenging things. Like, let's say you have an underperforming team member. Let's say your product owner is doing a poor job. Let's say your scrum master lacks courage. Mm-hmm. You have a mousy scrum master who doesn't, who can barely be heard, or some silly thing like that. But is actually affecting the performance of the team. The hard bits aren't raised.
Yeah, that's.
Have you seen that as well?
Yeah, there's a lot of people that end up coming to me of, what do I do? I'm like, have you brought it up in the retrospective? And they're like, well, I don't know how to do that. Everybody's very cautious of hurting others' feelings. We even have an aversion in my current company's culture to competition. Like, competition automatically has this negative connotation where, because you're competing, people are going to do their worst. Basically, they're going to cheat to win, right? So it's going to undermine our goal if we have a bug-squashing competition. The first thing that happens, like, well, our quality is going to go down because people are just going to do 1- and 2-line fixes to get it through.
It's like that worst-case view, right?
Yeah.
You could also look at it just easily, right? It's like they're going to go through the roof, right? Yeah. And we're going to, like, scrub quality. But yeah. No, we go to the dark side.
Yeah, so people have this negative connotation, and they don't want to upset the boat. They don't want to have somebody slightly, potentially upset with them. That's a difficult hurdle that I've seen a lot of my teams in the past couple of years try and get over. And the ones that are successful are the ones that, over time, learn to talk to each other and say, hey, what's going on, right? And it shouldn't be a big deal. It should be something in the sprint of, hey, you know, you're struggling with this. What can we do to help? What's going on?
That natural conversation, I agree with you. In a previous company, as a coach, I brought in, I forget the class, but we brought in a confronting your neighbor class. So a skills class, and we ran every team member through it for about a half a day, mm-hmm. which was, I think it was sort of confrontations, like healthy confrontations of team members. And I think that helped us.
Right.
Because I think part of it was people just didn't know how. Right. They were afraid, and more importantly, they didn't have the communication. I mean, when do you learn this in programming school, right?
Right.
It's when do you learn confrontation? When do you learn healthy confrontation? When to back off, when something's important. Mm-hmm. So we brought that in an effort to help. We focused on the 5 dysfunctions of a team a little bit, had folks read that. Did some brown bag study groups around that. We soft sold it because I don't know if you can come in and snap your fingers and improve it drastically, right? Create a highly...
Well, that's just going to get ugly.
Yeah. Yeah. So we didn't take that approach. But we were trying to be aggressive about it because the teams, they were really... I think retrospectives, until you get to that state, you're only like, you know, a third of what you can be as a team, or you're only progressing maybe at a third of the level that you can progress or advance. Because you're not, you know, those 800-pound gorillas, the things that are really going to enhance your performance, you're not attacking, you're not addressing them. So, I think that's a common practice. Do you attend the retrospectives?
I try to.
Do you?
I've got like 5 teams now, so I struggle to get to them all, but I do, and there have been times when I've been asked to lead a retrospective, and people are pretty responsive, because where our Scrum Masters struggle is they are very repetitive, right? So they'll do the same retrospective, and people are just like, they like slump back on their chair, like, oh, here we go again.
Really?
You know, and so that's one of my challenges to our Scrum Masters is to find ways, change, challenge, try things, and if it fails, it fails. All right, but at least you know it doesn't work. But yeah, to just elicit response—that's been one of our challenges in filling the Scrum Master role, is finding people that can elicit things like that, and people that will throw out a challenge, right? Of saying, "Well, guys, okay, we said these 5 things, but that's all like." We're nothing, right? We're not really saying anything. We're dancing around the issue, right? So that's one of the things in the retrospectives that I've been able to do that I'm trying to get our Scrum Masters to call those things out and be comfortable calling a team out, right? That's a big challenge that we've had some hurdles with.
So one of the things I've done differently, so I used to attend retrospectives much more frequently. Sort of like, and I think it's a learning curve or a coaching opportunity. Right. So paraphrasing what you said, you have some inexperienced Scrum Masters.
Yes.
And they need help. And you pop in and you help them, or you can pop in and help right. them. And I've had that pattern as well. In this case, in my current job, I haven't attended, I think I've attended one retrospective in over a year.
Right.
And that was as a filler for a Scrum Master who was out. So I was really acting as a Scrum Master, not as the director of R&D or something like that. But I've kept my nose out, and I think our Scrum Masters are attacking some of this stuff, but I don't know if we're accelerating the way I'd like.
Yeah, so all that I ask is that the teams post their retrospective notes on the wiki.
So we do that. So right. so that gives me insight into what was,
yeah.
you know, what the pattern is right. over time. But I wanted, you know, well, you know, the book tells you to create a safe environment for the team.
Right.
That's really what I'm trying to do. Sometimes, you know, I can be intrusive, right? My heart's in the right place, but I talk too much, believe it or not, and I can stick my nose in where it shouldn't. Heart's in the right place, but I'm sticking my nose where right. I shouldn't. And I'm always trying to improve. So this is an area where I've really tried to, like, keep my nose out of the retrospectives, but coach. I coach right. my butt off around the retrospectives, around the Scrum Masters, but let's see how they developed. You know, right. do they challenge the teams? And I think they're improving, but not quite. I think it's a key event. It really right. is. It really is that key event.
Right. So that's one of my key challenge points to our teams and to our Scrum Masters is, what are you doing to get better? Yeah. Right. Like that's one of my first questions of how are we going to do better this sprint?
Absolutely.
You know, and really challenging them to be prepared for that question. And what I want to get it to be is where I don't ask that question and they're asking that of themselves. But that's kind of stage N for us right now, just getting that mindset corrected, right? That's our biggest challenge.
So let's switch gears, talking about team leadership. And I'm just sitting, I know you have feelings around this. So I have this notion of, you know, leaders popping up. I use, what is it, whack-a-mole as mm-hmm. my mental example of that, my visual. And, you know, depending on the stories, depending on the technical challenges in a given team, I sort of expect technologists to pop up and leave that effort and then pop back down and to have that naturally happen. What do you do if no one pops up? Is something, well, no, I've seen this recently, yeah. you know, so the whack-a-mole Galen theory isn't always, you know, what if the machine breaks?
Right, exactly.
And there is, or what if all 10 heads pop up at the same time? So what do you think about, like, you know, team leadership? Does it matter in agile teams? Can it be overblown, underblown? How do you develop it? How do you foster it?
Well, I don't think it can be underblown. I don't think it can be overblown. I'm right in the middle. that's the least committal answer you'll ever get from me.
No, I know. I'm like, holy cow, thanks,
to Jim. Me, that's really the whole thing, and that's what I push is what I want to do is develop a team of leaders where the Scrum Master almost has their feet up on the desk and is kind of watching things run. That's my ideal position for a team, but that takes time. So one of the things that we try and do is really develop ownership. And when people feel the ownership, they tend to pick themselves up and say, okay, I've got to find a way to make this yeah. happen. And allowing that to happen organically over a period of X number of sprints to where it cycles through the entire team. And then not, it's tough because within teams you find a people fall into roles, sort of. And I challenge it at times, but there's times where I have to take a step back and say, maybe those are the roles that the team needs to be in to be as effective as possible. Maybe I don't like it that this person doesn't lead as much as this person, but when I challenge that and try and flip it, their productivity goes down because people are uncomfortable, they're not
yeah.
effective, they're not efficient. So there's times where I go to both extremes of backing way off and say, okay, so they're running smoothly, and maybe I would like to see a couple more leaders, but they're getting the job done, and I don't need to rock the boat at that point.
Boy, I like that insight, Josh. That's like knowing when to step in and when to step out. kind of, no, that nuance. You're giving me the evil eye like I'm being a smartass or something. I'm not.
Sorry, I'm just used to that.
I know. I'm not. I'm actually, I like that nuance. I mean, that's what I'm trying. You know, I think as coaches, if we aspire to be good, we have to improve as well. We have to observe. So I had a team member that wanted to, not that long ago, actually, and we haven't addressed this yet. So I was doing the Bob Galen whack-a-mole thing, talking about leadership, mm-hmm. because I was really I'm really reluctant to say, Josh Anderson, thou art the leader
right.
in a given team. I really am resistant to that, mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's good or bad, actually. But one team member was like, you know, and he's sort of an introvert and sort of, he's leading, but he's a peripheral leader.
Right.
And he's a great engineer. And he's like, why don't you pick someone, Bob? For God's sakes, we need a leader on the team. We have a real gap with technical leadership.
Right.
And I resisted it, but I resisted that. Yeah. What do you think about that?
I've had real luck with a technical lead.
But that's what he's asking
right.
for.
I don't like to define a team lead. I want the team to lead itself. But I've found real luck with. At least up front, defining a technical lead. And you, of course, have to make sure you have the right person that's in that role. But having a go-to person for questions, just so people know where they can go, is very helpful. As opposed to, okay, which of my five people do I ask? And understanding that your technical lead is going to be less productive because they're kind of the traffic cop and making sure that people are pointing in the right direction. But over time, the team sorts itself out, right? So it's like you only need it for the first, you know, six sprints or something like that. Once the team falls into its mode of everybody understands who knows what and who to go to and where to go and things like that. But
so do you decommission them?
No, it just becomes.
Does it really?
Yeah.
So it's just they fade away, and
they
the
don't
team
fade
doesn't
away,
defer
but they,
them.
They
you know I exaggerate to get
right. Them. So it's like they turn into Casper the Ghost, right? They aren't. Always there, but they're sort of there, you know. So they
but
help
you,
out.
But you always ask them first. You would always ask them first, like if you had a new project or you had a challenging theme or a challenging feature you were going to develop. Your behavior, I'm asking. Your behavior would be to go talk to them first,
right? So when I have a difficult problem and I don't want to pull the entire team, then I'll grab my technical leads and say, okay. I want to get a quick sampling of how crazy you think this is or how difficult this is going to be. Here's what I think, and throw it out to them and say, because they have the most experience and they understand their teams better than I do. Okay, well, we don't have the knowledge to make that happen, or this team does, or if we do this and this and this, then we can get it done. But because I like to involve the whole team, but there's times where that's not really the smart
yeah.
thing to do.
Yeah.
Right, so that's kind of my go-to team, but they also, as the manager for 20 people, I can't see everything that goes on within a team. So I rely on them very heavily for HR things of how are these people doing, or if we have a new contractor, they're the ones that are telling me, okay, this is working, this isn't working. So I do put a lot of...
So they can give you human performance feedback as well then.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So I don't even think in terms of... So you just stretched... My view. I'm oscillating on it. You know, my reticence is what? Is it going to neutralize the team's behavior, right? Because the team's going to look... I mean, my initial reaction to this guy was, no, we're not going to do that. I expect the team to lead itself.
Right.
I expect technology, right? I expect you guys to rise to the occasion appropriately. Yeah. Because we don't have single... It would be very difficult for us to establish single points. They wouldn't know everything
right. well,
for us.
Right, and they don't. But to me, it's like a point guard or a quarterback, right? So they're a part of the team, but they kind of know where everybody's supposed to be, right? They have that knowledge and that experience to be able to make those little redirections of, well, let's make sure we don't forget this, or let's do that, or make sure you talk to Susie over here. So it's that kind of thing where the team's not off the hook for leadership as a team, but as far as technical guidance and technical direction, I lean pretty heavily on those five folks to make that happen.
So one of my replacements, I want to come back to it. One of my replacement thoughts is to like actually have story leads, user story owners or feature leads.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not tying it to your role. I'm tying it to the work that's coming through the team.
Correct.
Have you tried that at all?
Yeah.
Is that a...
Actually, that's something that our teams ask for. We need somebody to own this feature and to really drive it. It can be a developer, tester, doesn't matter. Just somebody within our team is going to make sure that we make this feature happen. And that's something the teams ask for. I'm like, great. You know, and my initial response is, okay, let's just not make sure it's the same person, do it over and over again. But
exactly.
Then that's where I tried to bust it up, and the team just crumbled for like 3 or 4 sprints. And like, well, what happened? And I took a step back, like, okay, so they had a rhythm, and I destroyed it because I had this view that everybody should be able to do that. And yeah, everybody should, but not every team can realistically do
so
that.
So your feature leads or story leads are also your technical leads?
No, because the technical leads are spread a little bit too thin to make that happen realistically. What I want is a member of the team that can devote their whole being for that sprint to making that happen, whereas the technical leads get pulled in quite a few different directions with HR stuff.
So you have a small cadre, sort of your implementation, small cadre of technical... They're not team leads, but they're technical leads at a team. They're members of teams. Then you do have story owners or feature owners.
Right.
Now, it wouldn't be every team member would operate in that role. So those guys... folks would have... You would prefer it, but right now you still have specialized people who do that and some don't, is what I'm sensing.
Unfortunately, okay. Yes.
Mm-hmm. You can tell that I'm sort of starting to rethink it. Because I see the gap in our case. It's like domain experience is turning out. It's the research time is exhaustive, right?
Right.
The figure it out time is exhaustive for folks. We don't have the domain experience anyway. So in general, we lack a lot of historical domain experience. So I don't know where I would find those leads. We could have a few, but even they would be stressed out or stretched out. But I'm starting to rethink that. Maybe the name.
Yeah, that's, and I try and take a very hard stance on technical lead versus team lead.
Yeah, no, I'm purely on the technology side, and I'm rethinking that just because of some of the gaps that I've seen. The reading for me was Toyota. I forget what they call them, but Toyota, when they're doing, you know, so much of Agile has come from, or Lean Agile has
right.
come from the Toyota system, and they have the notion for a car. I don't know what they call it, a lead engineer, I think, or something engine. But there's a single engineer who is technically, and they own the design, they own the architecture, they own the business trade-offs, and they're one of the more broadly astute technologists
mm-hmm.
on the team, and they're sort of driving things. And one of the things that gets lost in, you know, us trying to model Toyota in Agile is their insistence of having a lead engineer for every project. And they talk about that person maintains the continuity, right? So there's, what is this? There's this convergence of business, you know, what the business wants versus what's technically feasible,
right.
Except they actually own those decisions. They own some of that convergence
right.
there. And from their point of view, I think that's a critical success factor. Those people also stress. So fine print. They don't. I think there's high suicide rate or something.
Yeah.
And there's an incredibly high burnout rate for those folks. So they don't. You know, they're like rising stars or something, or like suns.
Right.
And they flame out.
Yeah.
So they don't last long. But the point there is technical. So we can talk a really good game about all kinds of business related stuff. But at the end of the day, technical cohesion, I guess, is what I'm trying to, matters.
Right.
I think that's true in software as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can have all these yakkers around the periphery, but someone has to be like managing the technology boat, maybe at a feature level or
right.
at a system level.
Right. Correct.
Where do you want to go next?
Well, I tell
Teams,
you what,
are we
time's
out of time?
Flying here. We're at 40 minutes, and we're normally a 45-minute group here.
So I had put down some things, topics here, and not to have to go over them, but I put, when I was brainstorming before the Metacast, I put quality at a team level,
mm.
pairing, work results, like, you know, production, do they stretch? Maybe we touched on that with failure a little
right.
bit. but the notion of really stretching yourselves as a team and as an individual, estimates was something. In the retrospective, I think we beat it to death about confrontation, where we talked about it, and I had the five dysfunctions there related to that. Anything strike your fancy there?
Yeah, there's about three future topics on there.
Estimation, you think so? Have we touched on estimation at the Metacast before?
No.
Really?
I mean, we might have, like, touched it. So that's like tapped it on the head.
So that's like a gummy bear-ish. Yeah. That's like a rich landscape.
Yeah, we could do a whole series.
We could. I'd have to follow your lead on that. Is pairing. Why don't we wrap up with a few minutes on. So pairing.
Mm-hmm.
Josh Anderson, thoughts on the role of pairing in teams?
I've to use a Bob Galen term, I've oscillated on this topic.
I see you oscillating at the moment.
I promote it. I don't prescribe it. It's something that I am not a hardline XP person where that's the only way that we write code. I think it's a valuable tool. I've pushed it in past lives where we spend time doing a code review, so this is really just a code review in line, right? So you're doing that same thing. You're just sitting right there. So I'm for it. I'm not in love with it. I think it's helpful. I think you have to have the right team, the right mindsets. It's I think it can work. I don't think it's the only way that it can work.
I think we foster it. I don't like dictating it, which is what you're saying, I think. Right. I like fostering it. One of the things, though, I've noted, I think it actually helps with teamwork. I think it's one of those fundamental practices. If you have rotating pairs, if people are working together, if they're learning from each other, that they're sharpening. Stephen Covey, I don't remember Covey, the Seven Habits, mm-hmm. His last habit was sharpening the saw. So once you have the six habits, then don't lose it, right? Keep sharpening, keep practicing.
Right.
And I think a pairing is being sort of that sharpening the saw in your team thing. I think it would lead to retrospectives. I mean, we've actually noticed in our retrospectives lately that we've been like phoning in code reviews. So here we are. We were really proud as a culture. We're really proud of our code reviews.
Mm-hmm.
But then what we found recently is on some bugs, and when we looked at root cause, like on a series of really important, crucial bugs, it's like we were phoning it in.
Right.
Which just bugged the crap out of me. I'm like, how can we, here we invest in the time, and you see things, and you're not actually questioning your peers.
Right.
It's sort of like the, 800-pound, not attacking the 800-pound gorilla. So I think the pairing is a good practice. I think it helps with maybe confrontation, maybe sharpening our coding abilities.
Right.
Training newbies. One of the things that we found, we found that, you know, one great way to bring someone up to speed is by pairing with them.
Right.
But we've had pair avoidance in some cases. We've had some culture. We've hired some mature engineers, sort of in my age group, right?
Whoa.
Exactly. Well, so I said mature. I do. I said big M. Okay, big M mature.
Okay.
So we hired some big M mature engineers, and what we found is some of our little M mature engineers didn't want to pair with them,
right?
For whatever reason, right? They smelled old or something like that. You know how that is.
Yeah, I do.
So, but it actually encouraged us. So the pairing, surfaces all of this stuff around, collaboration,
right.
Teamwork, contribution and stuff. So I think the side effects of it can be healthy. But I've never once. Did I ever tell you my XP story?
No.
Maybe we could wrap with this.
Okay.
So do you remember the book, the Kent Beck, the white book on extreme programming? Did you?
Is it like just extreme programming?
It's just extreme programming explained or something. But it's the first book he published on XP. It came out, I think, in 1999 or 2000. I was at Lucent, and I was a software manager there, and I had a development team and a test team, and I was reading the thing, and he was very prescriptive at the time. If you're going to do Agile, you know, XP,
right.
you need to do all of these practices. So pairing was one of the practices, and he didn't give you a break. It was like, you know, if you're going to BXP pairing, you know how passionate I can get. So I'm like, I drunk the Kool-Aid. I'm like, yeah, we're gonna do all 10 of these practices. We're gonna do them well. So I found a few champions in the team, And we went out and we started rolling out X-Men. It was neat that I had testers and so I had a cross-functional responsibility. Right. So it gave me the ability, NBA, so it gave me the ability to influence really cool XP teams. But I remember I came out one day to all the development team, and this is Lucent. So we had some big and mature and little and mature. We had an eclectic mix, but mostly folks were like there for 15 years or more. And I'm like, you know, on Monday morning, get ready this weekend. Here, read the book over the weekend. On a Monday morning, and Ken was very precise. He's like, you don't produce one line of code unless it's in a pair.
Right.
So you do nothing unless it's in a pair. So I said, get ready for the weekend, and on Monday morning we're going to start pairing. On Monday morning, I think there was a line outside my door with folks with like pieces of paper in their hand.
They were all resigning?
They were resigning. I think I had a line of like 6 or 7 or 8 people.
And they
were gone. They were like, so, you're going to make me pair? I'm gone.
Right. So was that a bad thing?
I never thought about it. Thank you, Josh. Yes, it was.
Was it?
It okay. was. Yeah. Okay. These were folks who had domain experience. It would be like your leads. Yes, could I have cherry-picked a few from that long line outside my office and saved myself some trouble in the transition? Yes. But should I have taken the resignation letters from all of them? The answer is no. It was when it hit me in the face of, you know, dictating your prescription isn't
right,
a good
thing. Yeah.
And these were folks, they were just, and you know what the right answer was we started doing some pairing, and guess what happened 3 months later? With 80% of those folks. So we just started to do informal pairing
right.
in the teams, and guess what they were doing? They were pairing.
Yeah.
They were pairing. Not religiously, but they saw, when they saw value in it. Mm-hmm. And if I'd have come in heavy-handed, it wouldn't have worked out. But I'll never forget it. That was my one prescription, prescriptive or meant, you know, one that sticks out in my mind. So I'll never forget. And I'm like, I was like, holy cow. And these were the brains of the brains. And Lucent did not hire Fluff. We hired incredibly bright engineers. Mm-hmm. And I was going to lose, like, you know, probably 50% of the brain power in my team in one fell swoop. It was sort of funny in hindsight. I think we're done, Josh.
We are.
You look like you're pooping out. What's our next? We're looking. So how do we wrap this? We need to wrap this sucker up and put a bow on this thing. So we say thank you.
We say thank you.
We ask for feedback.
Feedback at metacast.com. That's meta-cast, the actual symbol, .com. We're on Twitter, meta-cast spelled out, because, again, Twitter doesn't like non-alphanumeric characters. So you can reach us there, email, whatever you got to do.
Yep.
Let us know. We want feedback.
Topics for discussion. We are committed to this. We're going to do another one in a week. We'll get back to our weekly our weekly tempo. You and I have even talked about maybe overdoing it a little bit, so having some in the can so we don't go away for so long. Looking for topics. Have a thought for next time. We can either talk estimation. I did go to Agile 2010, so I could generate some observations from that.
Nice.
And we could react back and forth off of that.
That would be good.
Like Kanban was something that was one of the themes in Agile 2010 that was just folks were, there were, I mean, Kanban exploded.
They were all over it.
So year to year, it was just, last year it was just hinted around a little bit. The year before that, you know, just a smell here and there in the hallway. This year, a lot of focus. So there were some critical things.
I think that's
things.
Kind of, that could give us the pulse of the Agile world.
Well, and I want us to talk about it, because sometimes the Agile world chases its tail, I think, and chases the sexiest new thing and defocuses from the basics as well.
Right.
So we can talk about that. That might be a topic for next time in estimation.
That sounds good.
But we're open. So from beautiful downtown Cary, North Carolina, I'm Bob Galen.
And I'm Josh Anderson.
Shake.
And bake.
Everyone take care out there.